Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now, and there have been major developments and a flurry of activity in the London bombing investigation today, including at least one armed standoff, as police conducted a number of arrests around the city. An eyewitness told Sky News what happened as police raided the home of one of her neighbors after demanding that he come into the street in his underwear to avoid hiding explosives.
After about 15 minutes of them not having contact with him, you heard like the gunshots go off. Whether they were gunshots or, you know, the tear gas cylinders, I don't know. But after you heard that and the SWAT team started to run round there, the forensic vans went round there as well, and then some of the suits went round there as well. And then when the the SWAT team started to come back round and take off their stuff, I asked one of them if I could now come out, and they said to me, yeah, because the guy had obviously been taken.
Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb joins us now. Michael, what I'm imagining is a rattled London.
Rattled, and as the news settles in, probably a little relieved. Yesterday, Sir Ian Blair, who's commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, that is the chief of police for London, you know, reminded everyone that these fellows had meant to kill themselves last week and hinted that they may still have access to explosives. So everyone has been very much on edge. But today, the police, in two separate raids about a mile apart in West London, did manage to arrest, we're told, two of the three remaining bombers from last week's failed attempt to set off bombs around the London underground system and on the buses. And it was all incredibly dramatic because, as you heard from that woman just now, where reporters could not get, the public was. And there was kind of like a community media presence going on there. It was quite extraordinary.
People who lived in the neighborhood. Well, we saw pictures here, including one of police in some sort of coverall suits leading someone away who looked as if he was wrapped like a mummy.
Yes, he was actually the suspect, the man who's alleged to have planted a bomb that did not detonate at the Oval underground station last Thursday. This followed a long siege, which was actually dramatically relayed again via the community. A woman who lived in an apartment just behind where all the action was held her telephone out the window so that we could all listen. And we heard astonishing dialogue with the SWAT team demanding this man called Mohammed come out. We heard negotiation because they were insisting that he remove all his clothes because they were concerned that he might be wearing the suicide bomber's belt. And then we heard the sequence of it sounded to me like about half a dozen concussions as stun grenades were fired into the flat. And then he was led out in a white plastic jumpsuit, and the police are wearing blue plastic jumpsuits. He's now at Paddington Green High Security Police Station.
And we understand the jumpsuits were to keep any evidence on his body that they might detect. So, Michael, in the minute and a half we have, catch us up. How many suspects have been taken in?
There were four bombs last week that failed to go off. A fifth was found in a London park over the weekend. Three men are now in custody, alleged to have been the bombers, which means there's one or possibly two people still at large in this, and of course police continue to pursue them. Today's activity, however, is extremely interesting. When the first arrest was made earlier in the week, it came in an operation at 4:30 in the morning, complete surprise. Today's activities began mid-morning, which means that whatever tip the police had about the whereabouts of these two alleged bombers must have come very suddenly. Yeah. And so everyone is expecting that the other bombers at large will be caught in, you know, similar sudden moves.
And Michael, one last question. This was not in a township outside of London. This was in the heart of London.
This was the heart of London. This was in Notting Hill. You know, people who've been to see the film Notting Hill will remember scenes of Portobello Road open air market. One arrest was made probably 100 yards from the Portobello Road. you know, these were arrests that took place in a neighborhood that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Greenwich Village or, you know, the South End in Boston, a place where wealthy bohemians and more raffish element meet.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London about the flurry of activity today there. Two suspects said to be arrested after several police raids. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
In what one senator is calling perhaps the most important speech made on the Senate floor in years, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist today told lawmakers he now supports expanded federal financing for embryonic stem cell research, a decision that puts Frist, a possible presidential candidate, squarely in opposition to President Bush and the religious conservatives that Frist had been courting. Frist, a doctor, pointed out that he still opposes abortion, but he noted that of the 78 existing stem cell lines approved for research by President Bush, few have proven viable for research.
Those lines, unexpectedly, after several generations, are starting to become less stable and less replicative than initially thought.
Frist's speech today puts the exclamation point on the end of a very busy week in Washington. Joining us with a wrap-up, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, it has been quite a week, hasn't it?
Unbelievable. This the last week in July usually does have a lot of activity, the way deadlines can focus a mind. Mm-hmm. But I think this year especially so, because some of the things we're seeing go through today and yesterday have been pending for years.
Well, let's go through some of them. Frist's statements today. It was Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter who said Frist's speech was perhaps the most important one in the Senate in years. Senator Specter is battling cancer. So obviously an interest in stem cell research. So do you agree with his take?
Absolutely. This is absolutely, probably, I don't know if it's the most important speech of the whole year, but this is it's a very important development because it moves Frist, whose main credential has been as someone who is both a right-to-lifer but who can stride the scientific world, knows science, is a respected heart and lung surgeon, a pioneer before he came to the Senate. And this is something that has been a real chasm in the Congress. Who can speak to both sides of this debate? And Frist has positioned himself as someone who can do that. Now, whether he can, this will hurt him in the end, or whether he can actually broker some compromise in the middle is going to be very interesting to see. But I agree with Senator Specter that this was a speech that everyone paid attention to.
Well, and the question is, hurt him with who? Can this be interpreted as a backing away from religious conservatives? Because polls show that most Americans agree with Frist.
Well, it's not most Americans that determine Republican primaries. Mm-hmm. And that's the group he's looking at, the Christian conservatives, who are the party's vital base. And you have to get through them if you're interested in a primary run. That's the difference.
Well, and
The speech to listen to is the one almost immediately after Senator Frist, which was Sam Brownback, who has been probably the strongest pro-life senator here, and also very strong on issues like slavery. And the term that he used is, we have to decide whether an embryo is a human life that deserves dignity and respect, or is it property and its master can determine what to do with it. Now, I've already seen quotes of that that say that the term he used was owner, but it was master. And that's a term that gives an indication of the emotional power of this issue, especially if, as he does, you try to link it to slavery and a wider range of issues about human dignity.
Mm. What does this mean in relation to President Bush? Because Bill Frist a month ago said he did not support expanded stem cell financing at this juncture. It appears the juncture that is right for him to say this has occurred. So what does that mean?
I think the president is in a much tougher position right now, because with Frist backing him, you know, the compromise that he made back on August 9th, 2001, his first primetime televised speech, the compromise he made was, look, we know that an embryo is human life. We know that destroying it is a bad thing. However, these are embryos that have already been determined, slated for destruction. There are stem lines that have already been established. So as of Any stem line that exists before August 9th, those can be used. Any after that cannot. Now, that's a morally tough position. Why not August 10th if it could save the life of my uncle? Mm-hmm. Why not, 2006? And that's the territory that Frist just left him standing in alone.
Mm-hmm. What does this mean, though, for the legislation that's been stalled?
Well, I think it gives it a real shot in the arm. Now, I was listening carefully to what Frist said, and I need to talk to some more people about this, but what Republicans who support this bill had wanted, Representative Castle, Senator Specter, was to immediately move the House bill to the floor. Now, what I heard him say was he supports that bill, but he feels that it doesn't have enough ethical safeguards in it, and he doesn't want to see that done by just amending it from the floor. He'd like to see more time spent on putting together a more comprehensive bill. What I heard him say is time. Now, that's not what Senator Specter wanted. He wanted a vote immediately on this. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Well, this announcement by Bill Frist may be viewed as a setback for President Bush's agenda, but otherwise, it's been a good week for the president. The House just passed the $286.4 billion highway and mass transit bill, the energy bill wrapping up. There's CAFTA. It's been a good week.
Yes. What's interesting to me is how those all relate to each other. The CAFTA trade bill was a very, very difficult vote. 25 Republicans voted no, only 15 Democrats. Remember the last time free trade came up in the House, 75 Democrats voted in favor of it. Labor unions were telling Democrats that if they backed this bill, they could expect no support from labor in tough races. This was a very, very difficult vote.
Mm. Gail Taddeck, I want you to comment overall on the energy bill. We're going to talk more about it in just a moment, but critics are saying it's just a boondoggle for industry. Your take on how it's viewed?
The energy bill is a perfect example of a Congress in gridlock. That is, it doesn't make any decisions about what the country's energy future is and put money there. In fact, in effect, funds everything. You're seeing a package of about $14.5 billion in tax breaks. That's double what the president wanted. About more than 60% of it is going to industries like oil and natural gas that are enjoying record profits, prompting the question that even the president is supposed to have asked behind the scenes, why are we subsidizing industries that are making a huge profit?
Truly.
About 38% went into renewables.
But I have to back you up there for a second. President Bush was reported to have said that?
No, none of this is confirmed, of course, but he has made some very interesting comments behind the scenes that get passed down. As to whether or not we're really spending money wisely. He doesn't want $14.5 billion spent on energy. He wanted $6.7. And when he looks at what the spending is on, he's raising questions like, do we really need to subsidize industries that are already making a great deal of money? So this is a question that the Senate and the House, when they got together in the conference bill, were faced with either making a decision. The House bill was very heavy toward traditional industries like oil and gas. The Senate bill very heavy towards renewables.
Well, Gail Taddeck, I'm going to hold you up right there because we want to continue more with Gail's thoughts on both the energy bill and other bills in Congress and on the Hill, including one that might make it harder for you to buy your cold medication. You're going to have to sign a log to get Sudafed. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. And now we're continuing our Friday conversation on all the legislation that's moving in Congress this week as lawmakers pack their bags to go on summer break. Gail Taddeck is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us again on the line from Washington. Gail, we were just talking about the energy bill. You saying that even President Bush reportedly was aghast at the amount of money that seemed to go to industries that are doing quite well. And I also want to note that Republicans are perhaps rubbing their arms this Friday, icing them down because of the arm twisting on Capitol Hill this week, particularly during the vote for the Central American Free Trade Agreement. How close was it?
They won with two votes after, as they did with the Medicare prescription drug bill.
These are the Republican White House backers of the bill.
That's right. They held the vote in the House beyond the 15 minutes. At the 15-minute mark, the trade bill had gone down. But by holding the vote open, talking, cajoling, promising, arm-twisting, they managed to eke out a victory just short of the 218, which would have been a powerful symbolic statement. Mm-hmm. They just got 217.
And they got bipartisan support for CAFTA. And
barely.
Barely. But also for the $286 billion highway bill that the House just passed.
Yes.
Though I understand there was some last-minute wrangling on language there. Someone noticed that a provision tucked in this huge bill called for the reopening of a military base?
Christopher Shea's notice that slipped into the conference bill by Senator Baucus was something which would have reopened a runway, and he went ballistic. And they ended up pulling it from the bill, and then Senator Baucus went ballistic. This is the kind of thing that typically goes on at the last minute. You can slip something in unnoticed, but at a time when there is so much scrutiny over the spending that's going on and basic fairness, and Christopher Shays has developed a reputation as a kind of straight shooter who doesn't mind offending, ruffling feathers on a matter of principle. So that was pulled at the last minute and the bill passed.
Well, we want to quickly check some other legislation, including one involving cold medication. The Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday approved limiting access to cold medication, you know, putting it behind the counter, making you sign out logs, because if those cold medications have the thing that's at the base of crystal methamphetamine, a substance that is used to make crystal meth. It's such interesting legislation.
Well, there are thousands of bills like this in the Congress, and it's always interesting what causes them to pop to the surface. And I can't tell you why this one emerged at this time, but it's typical also of this season.
Yeah, and there's last news just coming out that Republican and congressional officials are saying Supreme Court nominee John Roberts' confirmation hearing will begin on September 6th. And about the minute we have, we understand there was some wrangling over that.
Huge. What was going on there, Senator Specter wants a commitment that the Democrats on the committee aren't going to draw these hearings out past the October start date. And he was threatening to pull them back from the precious August break and start these hearings in August if there was even any question of dragging it out. So if they've now set a date in September, it's because they have a commitment that that's not going to happen.
And there was news that John Bolton, you know, people wonder whatever happened to John Bolton, might be a recess appointment for UN ambassador.
I've heard that too. I'd say that's very possible. I'm not sure the impact it would have on the judicial nominations, because the president had assured the Senate the last time he made a judicial appointment that he would not do it again. So there might be some concern over whether or not the principle, the spirit of that agreement has been violated if that happens.
Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much for checking in with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, one provision of the energy bill that we mentioned that's been kind of overlooked would affect nearly everyone in the country. It would expand daylight saving time by 4 weeks. Now, backers say that will save on electricity by giving Americans more daylight. Opponents, though, worry about children getting under their school buses in the dark and other things. In some states, including Indiana, a state with three different time zones, daylight saving time has already created something of a controversy. Joining us on the line is Steve Sullivan, president of the Farm Bureau in Cass County, Indiana. He's in Logansport, right on the time zone dividing line in Indiana. Steve, why are there so many time zones in Indiana?
I think it depends on which side of the state you're on and what commerce area you're working with in terms of businesses and delivering your grain or do whatever. But the western side of the state favors Chicago time, and the eastern side of the state is pretty adamant they like eastern time.
Right. Well, we understand some people in Illinois want to keep the different time zones because it benefits them because they get to watch television programs earlier, right?
Yeah, we've encountered that ourselves. We can dial up South Bend and get 1 hour television, headed toward Indianapolis, and get the same show on a different hour. So it gives a little flexibility.
Right, you get to watch news earlier and go to sleep earlier.
Sure.
But how would much more daylight savings times affect farmers? I would think, you know, since you'd have less light in the morning, more at night, farmers get up early. You'd be working in the dark a lot longer.
Well, yeah, you're up in the morning early if you got livestock and so on, and the livestock are going to react to the daylight length, not the clock.
Well, wait a minute. Livestock react to the light. That means the cows are going to sleep late. Doesn't it?
Yeah, well, they're tuned to, they don't use clocks, and they're not involved in the time issue. They go by whatever the daylight length is.
Yeah.
More than not.
What are some of the other problems that Indiana confronts because you have so many different time zones in one place?
confusion on what time it is in Indiana when you're dealing with other businesses. That's the point the governor made clear, and why he'd like to straighten it out. And I have a daughter who works for a company that deals all states and internationally even, who's made the point to Dad, me, that people are really confused about what time it is in Indiana, and I have to deal with that all the time.
Mm. You know, we've talked about all these different things, when the cows get up, some mm-hmm. of the different problems, but what does it boil down to, people? Is it perhaps an inconvenience, or just that they don't like change?
The biggest view they expressed?
Yeah.
They didn't want to change their clocks. Mm. My personal opinion is we would be better off to have more of the state in uniformity, so I could see, for my own opinion, central time with daylight, and that would bring those 10 counties, 5 in the northwest, 5 in the northeast, in line with the rest of us, and we wouldn't have as much confusion.
Steve Sullivan is president of the Farm Bureau in Cass County, Indiana, where they are split on the future of time zones and daylight savings and all of that. Steve, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome. I hope it was worth your time.
It was more than. See, get it? Time?
Yeah, I got that. Appreciate it. Thank you. I hope it was worthwhile.
And next week on Here and Now, futurist Ray Kurzweil on achieving immortality through technology. But what about God? That's next week. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. The British Army is shutting down and knocking down 3 military bases in Northern Ireland after the Irish Republican Army yesterday announced the end of its 36-year-old war. IRA commanders have promised to fully disarm and begin to dump their weapons. The group says it now plans to work peacefully through political channels. Here and Now's Bob Oakes spoke to Boston Globe reporter Kevin Cullen, who's long covered the IRA and is covering the disarmament, and asked about whether the peace would last.
Kevin, the IRA has made similar promises before, as we know. How firm is this one? You quote Bertie Ahern, Ireland's prime minister, in your article this morning in the Globe as saying the war is over. Do you think it is?
Yeah, actually, I've been saying it's over since 1994. And last night I was with a bunch of former and current IRA men in a IRA social club, and talking to them, I think it became even more apparent that they assume that the war has been over for quite a while, too. But I think yesterday's statement was in fact, historic, because it was the IRA going on record saying they can't do all the ancillary things that they do. Shooting Brits and shooting cops was what they considered the war. But, you know, they do an awful lot of other things, including the intimidation and vigilante justice doled out to hoods in their own neighborhoods. And that supposedly is going to stop. And if in fact that does stop, and we see there is evidence that the IRA is not doing this anymore, then I think we can say that the IRA is no longer a paramilitary organization.
What's the timing of this? Why now?
Well, mostly it's to get the institutions of local government back up this has always been about power, who wields it. The conflict began 35 years ago because the power was wielded exclusively by the local unionist government, and the Catholics were treated much like blacks were treated in America in the 50s and 60s, and it was an issue of power and civil rights. Then it became an issue of conflict power. It was a fight between the IRA, loyalist paramilitary groups, and the British government in the form of the army and the police. And now it's really been about who gets to distribute this power, who gets to wield it. And it's going to be through governmental democratic institutions. And the IRA knew that as long as it existed as a paramilitary organization, there was not going to be a normal democracy here. And so their effort is to put them to the side so that unionists here on the ground, mostly Protestants, would have no excuse not to engage with Sinn Féin, their political allies, and get the institutions of government up and running again.
Well, beyond the relationship with Sinn Féin, is the IRA ready to become a political force? I mean, is it organized enough to be able to make headway in politics locally and nationally?
That's a good question, because its best political organization arm were the prisons. That's where most IRA guys became really political. Most guys get involved in the IRA in their teens. They're not especially political. They wanted to hit out. We've had 10 years of not obvious violent conflict. So the political education of the average IRA man has been not as extreme. Let's face it, when they're in prison, it was like a full-time program. It's a lot different out on the street. But, you know, I mean, everything, like at this place where I was last night, there's a political edge to everything if you're an Irish Republican. Everything you think about is through a political prism. So certainly the mechanisms are there. I think the bigger, the broader question is, does any human being give up power when they have it? And these IRA men, and particularly IRA commanders, have an extraordinary amount of local power. And whether they can walk away from that and just dedicate it to political activism, I think is what we need to watch and see this play out.
And in your article this morning in the Globe, you point out that there is some skepticism. You quote Jeffrey Donaldson, member of Parliament for the Democratic Unionist Party, the Unionists, who says it'll take months, if not years, for them to see whether the IRA is sincere.
Yeah, I think using months is probably fair. Using years is pretty extraordinary. But, yeah, I think, I mean, the unionists have heard this all before. They don't believe the IRA's words. They will only believe their actions. But, you know, historically, it's very interesting. In 1962, the IRA actually dumped arms after a failed campaign. It was a much smaller conflict, much smaller organization. But nobody was making demands on them to show the weapons. Nobody was making demands. Basically, when the IRA says something, they usually mean it. Now, there's been a lot of dodging and fudging in the last 10 years on all sides when it comes to doing what they say and saying what they mean. But I think that unionists are going to sit back for at least months and watch and see. You know, does a kid in a Catholic area turn up with a gunshot in his leg, or does he turn up with his legs or his arms broken in a beating? You know, things like that. They're going to see, is the IRA really stepping back from paramilitary activity and just engaging in strictly political activity? And that's something you can only judge with time.
Boston, of course, for many, many years, was a bastion of support for the IRA. What do you imagine the local reaction to this move being?
Well, I think it's going to be very supportive. I think that, you know, people, Boston is always like other parts of Irish America. It's varied. There are people who support the IRA, but there are also people who support moderate nationalism and would be more supporting the Irish government and the SDLP. But it was really interesting yesterday when I took the train down to Dublin to see Gerry Adams give his statement. Over his shoulder was a fellow named Martin Ferris, who was a senior IRA commander back in the 80s. In fact, he was caught in 1984 on a boat that had sailed from Boston laden down with over $1 million worth of weapons bound for the IRA. And Martin was put in prison and spent 10 years in prison. And he got out, and he's now very involved with Sinn Féin, the political arm of which has now taken the ascendancy in the Republican movement. Last time Martin was on a boat in Boston Harbor was a couple of years ago, and it was a very expensive fundraiser, highfalutin fundraiser for Sinn Féin. And that's what's happened, I think, if you look at through the Boston angle, from, you know, 20-odd years ago when Boston was the center of the biggest gun-running operation ever in the United States for the IRA. Fast forward to 20 years, and then you have the fellow that was involved in the IRA operation now wearing a nice suit and tie, and there he is. He's a respectable politician. And that's what's happened. We, you know, people that were gunmen and gun runners are now politicians, and that's where the conflict has moved. And I think we all should be thankful for that, because as I said to a fellow last night in the IRA club, he asked me what I thought, and I said, this is a hell of a lot better than covering funerals.
That's Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe. He spoke to Here and Now's Bob Oakes about the Irish Republican Army's announcement yesterday ending its 36-year war. Well, still to come, what is Kwaito music? This is what it sounds like. When we come back, what it means. You're listening to Here and Now.
Mora rapa suya pagamos o panas de siso. Crime ya es en esa onda son. Mientras pio
I'm pro-choice about everything. Helmet free, it's up to me. Buckle up, I'll decide. These bumper stickers grace the cars of free staters. 2 years ago, they launched a campaign to get 20,000 liberty-minded people to move to New Hampshire to affect politics and public policy. According to the group's website, nearly 6,000 people have already pledged to make the move. Well, this week, the free staters are holding their second annual Pork Fest, named after their mascot, the porcupine, in Lancaster, New Hampshire. And we thought we'd check in. We have the group's president, Amanda Phillips. Amanda, hello.
Hi.
And lead festival organizer, Varen Swearingen. Varen, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you.
Amanda, can you tell me the swath that your group cuts across?
Well, the word libertarian, when you're using it to describe a political philosophy, basically means that the government should exist only to protect life, liberty, and property, and nothing more. So generally, that's what libertarians believe. I did want to note that we're small-L libertarians, so we're not tied with any specific party. Though we do have a lot of Libertarian Party members, we also have Republicans, Democrats, Greens, and many independents. We have a lot of people on the left who believe that the government should stay out of your bedroom and not tell you what to do with your body.
So, for instance, somebody might be pro-gay marriage.
Yeah, so someone on the left who is in favor of, the government getting out of your bedroom, would be sympathetic to someone on the right saying, well, we also want the government out of our business and out of our wallets.
Well, you also have people, as you said, who are from all points on the political spectrum who believe in all sorts of different things. I mean, for instance, someone might believe in legalizing prostitution. Someone else might believe in getting rid of helmet and safety belt laws. So how do these disparate beliefs pull together?
Well, the thing that unites us all is that we do believe that the maximum role of government should be the protection of life, liberty, and property.
You have picked New Hampshire. In fact, New Hampshire beat out 9 other states when you were looking for the state to settle in. The motto is live free or die. Do you worry that others are saying, wait a second, we don't want a group imploring other people to come here to change our government?
Well, we're not so much looking to change the government of New Hampshire, but to preserve the freedom that already exists in New Hampshire. Any changes that we might want to make, we would still need to convince, a large number of people that these are good solutions.
Amanda, how many people have moved to New Hampshire at your appeal so far?
We've had about 150 people move in.
Well, I understand, Varen Swearingen, you and your wife moved from Fresno to New Hampshire last year. Were you compelled by the Free Staters' appeal, and what compelled you?
Yeah, that is in fact why we chose New Hampshire. New Hampshire is already significantly more free than California, where we came from.
Wait. Varen, that anybody hearing that sentence, especially in the East, is saying, wait, a state that's freer than California? What do you mean?
Well, in terms of personal freedoms, there are several examples, and the California state legislature continues to crack down. I mean, now teenagers can't go to tanning beds, and the list is very long, but as far as personal freedoms, there are little telltale signs, like adults are not mandated by law to wear seatbelts in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is one of only 2 states with no state income tax and no state sales tax.
Without taxes, or with much, much reduced taxes, how do public works projects get built? How do roads get built? How do hospitals get built?
The Free State Project itself would not involve itself in coming up with those solutions, but when you plunk down thousands of very creative people who want to do that, they can come up with more than I could certainly think of off the top of my head.
So you're saying it should come from the people and not the government?
That's right.
Well, Varen, you are the festival organizer, the festival taking place this weekend. What does a Free Stater do at a festival?
There are families doing family outings. We have speakers and forums. There's a rock concert. There are 3 religious gatherings. So it's everything under the sun. It's sort of an expression of the freedom that we all love.
And Amanda, the festival named after your mascot, the porcupine. Why the porcupine?
The porcupine uses his quills only for self-defense. So we thought it was the perfect symbol of our project because libertarians believe that force should only be used in self-defense and not for aggression.
Amanda Phillips is the national media rep and president of the Free State Project. Varen Swearingen is the festival organizer of the project's annual hoedown, which is going on right now. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
It's Here and Now.
Coming at you. Live. From the Guaito capital of the world, 99.2 YFM.
You can hear it all over South African radio. It's a type of music that's come to define the post-apartheid generation there. It's called Guaito. Guaito, K-W-A-I-T-O, is an urban mix of house music, hip-hop, and a slew of South African styles. Culturally and economically, it is to young black South Africans what hip-hop is to young black Americans. Well, Sean Cole of WBUR's documentary unit Inside Out traveled to South Africa to find out more about Guaito, and he's here to tell us what he found. Sean, what are we listening to?
Ghetto Fabulous. It's a song by Zola, who is probably the most popular Guaito performer there. Zola is also the name of the section of Soweto where he's from, and he took that name to acknowledge his roots.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty standard for a lot of Guaito. There's that, you know, distorted metallic quality to it. You can hear the house music influence. Mm-hmm. And he's also rapping over the beat, obviously. And the whole thing is sung in Zulu with some English and other languages thrown in. Since apartheid ended, South Africa's become a place of 11 official languages. And that's the kind of amalgamation that Guaito is all about and that South Africa is all about in some ways.
So we'll learn more about the country as we learn about the music. Do we know what he's saying?
We do. I happen to have him right here translating.
Not in our laps
otherwise.
I don't see him, right?
So here he is. First he goes through the Zulu and then tells you what it means in English.
Tineka siketo fabulous. Evele vele was ban. Mhlambe namhlanje ngithi sijive ukugcina. And if I die, but la muhlale wazi ngiyakuthanda. We, the people of the ghetto, no matter what goes on, we are still ghetto fabulous. We're still happy, and we're still united. And even though we're dancing today, somebody could pull out a gun and kill one of us here. So just in case that happens, I just want you to know, my brother, that I love you. That's what I was talking about. It was a happy song, but it still talked about the reality of that within a situation of happiness, something wrong may happen.
So again, that's Zola. I talked to him outside of the recording studio where he was making his fourth album. And I just love that quote of within a situation of happiness, something wrong may happen. Because I feel like it really sums up today's South Africa in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, here we have our democracy. It's 11 years after apartheid ended. There's this burgeoning black middle class. But at the same time, you know, AIDS is rampant. Crime is rampant. Crime is driven by poverty, which is rampant. And so there are all these new struggles that have sprung up in the wake of the struggle.
So it sounds as if Guaito singers are much like the American counterparts, rappers, who also take on social issues. I'm thinking of Public Enemy or others.
No, you're right. It actually mirrors hip-hop in a couple of ways. I mean, there's the socially conscious hip-hop, but there's also, obviously, party down, get your freak on hip-hop. And Guaito is the same way. You know, I mean, it was born at the end of apartheid when all of a sudden black people were free. They could go where they wanted. They could live where they wanted if they had the means. A lot of the songs are just about celebrating and partying, but they could also say whatever they wanted without worrying about retribution, getting arrested, etc. So and they started expressing, you know, all of that pent-up frustration as well. Let's listen to another song. This is called Kaffir, and it's by Arthur Mafokate.
Hey, Jaruf! Jaruf!
Come here, Kaffir, come here!
This is a track that a lot of people talk about when they talk about the early days of Guaito. Kaffir is actually a racial slur. It's what a lot of bigoted white Afrikaners might have called their black servants when they wanted to demean them. And, you know, it begins with this skit, basically, where this white Afrikaner is, you know, yelling at a servant for not filling up the gas tank, and the servant responds to the boss in English.
Boss.
Arthur Mafokate, one of the originators of Guaito. So, Sean Cole, what does he say about what he's saying?
Well, he was actually featured in this documentary movie about Guaito called Sharp Sharp by Arian Kaganoff. And here is a moment from that film.
For me, it was like, Mandela is free. I'm a free person. I'm going to say what I need to say. And people will learn out of what I'm saying. And they'll put it in their history books that apart from whatever we achieved as Africans, there were still those brave ones that would continue with the struggle to now educate other people that don't just forgive. You must remember.
So it sounds as if, to hear Arthur Mafokate say it, this music, Kwaito, is very much linked to apartheid when he says, don't just forgive, you must remember.
Yeah, and that's the thing about this generation. They really are moving on from the past. They have to, in a way, because there are so many other immediate problems to face. But at the same time, they've really vowed never to forget what happened to their parents and to even them as children during the apartheid era. Zola, for example, says, you know, told me that Afrikaner police actually kicked his mother while she was pregnant with him. He says, I got the struggle in my mother's tummy. And he also talks about being born the same year that Stephen Biko was killed. Arthur is not much older.
Right, so it's very much on their minds. But how have they moved on? I mean, how do they move on?
Well, another way that Kwaito is like hip-hop is that it's given opportunities, financial opportunities, to young blacks that would have just been unthinkable before. I mean, Arthur has his own record label, 999 Music. Zola's doing really well for himself. He owns 10% of the label that signed him, which is called Ghetto Ruff. They're a big label in terms of Kwaito and also South African hip-hop, which is coming up. Underneath Kwaito now. And he also has his own TV show, which is a reality TV show. He goes around the country and sometimes the continent solving people's problems. he owns a music company called Gulliver Entertainment, which means hustler. You know, so again, he's not forgetting his roots. And the thing is that these black-owned labels and businesses are employing other people. They're employing producers, engineers, marketing people. So Kwaito's led to this whole cultural economy that's really been empowering for young blacks. There's this one company, it's a multimedia company called Black Rage Productions. It's been around for a little less than 10 years, and it produces albums and has a street culture TV show called Street Journal, and it has this online culture magazine called Rage. I talked to the editor of Rage, Maria McCloy, and she was telling me that part of the reason she does the website is to dispel a lot of the myths that we have over here in America about South African culture.
It's about also showing the world we're not just about Mira Makeba, Huma Sekela, and traditional dances. Something else is happening over here. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge we moved on. You're not listening to the Beatles and Elvis anymore, and we're not listening to 60s stuff and, you know, only dancing around the fire doing a traditional song or whatever the stereotype is, you know? And I think some people in the West might not want to acknowledge, you know, modern urban Africans doing great. They want to think of just starving Africans and all that. Thanks for your help, but please acknowledge the very wonderful things that's happening here.
So that's Maria McCloy, who edits the online magazine Rage. And that was really eye-opening for me, as what she said, as someone who's never been to South Africa, or Africa, for that matter, before, and, you know, just thought of it in terms of racism and AIDS and poverty and all of these things that are real, obviously very traumatic and vivid concerns there. But there's also this, you know, whole sophisticated cultural matrix there as well that I wasn't expecting, and that's simultaneously responding to those concerns and in a way, in a small way, doing something about them.
Sean Cole of WBUR Boston's documentary unit Inside Out. Sean, thanks for sharing your eye-opening experience with us.
Thanks, you're welcome.
And for more information about Kwaito music and to hear the full documentary, South Africa's Kwaito Generation, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.